Zeus and his pals are looking down onto the mortal world, taking in these hapless creatures who they've created, and some of them making fun of us mortals. But Zeus, envies us our mortality. And Banville has him say, "This is the mortal world. It is a world where nothing is lost, where all is accounted for, while yet the mystery of things is preserved. A world where they, we mortals, may live, however briefly, however tenuously, in the failing evening of the self, solitary and at the same time together somehow, here in this place, dying as they may be, and yet fixed forever in a luminous, unending instant." So there we have our condition, where the very parenthesis of the life grants the life its meaning. And so those of us into whose hands have been placed the care of the mortal body are responsible for far more than the mortal body, but rather the meaning that may accrue to it. And sometimes we know that. I look at Dr. Bondurant. He's been at this for a long time. And he has brought, it's so thrilling that you're here, because he's brought into the enterprise of medicine, and of academic medicine in particular, which in some funny ways is a sharper creature than some of the other kinds. And he's brought into it this luminous gaze and awareness of what it is that we do. Because Barry and I and others of you here share a propensity, Howard, Carter, we share a propensity toward thinking about illness as it unfolds in stories. We think that it perhaps can best be explained and even perhaps experienced as a thing, an event, a set of circumstances, a condition that unfolds in stories. Right from the beginning, somehow the body tells through symptoms, something tells the person who lives in that body something's amiss. Whatever, a symptom, a headache, a bellyache. Something's amiss. That's the beginning of the story. That person to whom the body has told now maybe tells it to someone else. Your friend, your sister, your mommy. I got a headache. What about that? The story, if it gets serious enough, gets told to, I don't know, his personal trainer at the gym or the pharmacist. What do? I have a headache. Eventually, the story gets told to one of us. And we know what we do with the story. We turn around and tell it to somebody else. So this whole circulation of the tellings and the retellings and the embellishments and the deepenings and the contradictions and the interpretations all the way about. If the symptoms are to be dealt with, it'll be because somebody hears about them who knows what to do. But the vector of the knowledge is typically through these tellings that go on in many different ways. Some people assume that stories have beginnings and middles and ends. Those of us who read enough of them or tell enough of them know that's simply not the case. Not the case. Stories are not linear things. They're, to my mind, more like storms at sea than measuring sticks. I mean, you know, you guys, you're the coast. You know from storms at sea. The winds come from nowhere, waves tower, horizons tilt, ships sink, winds subside, uneasy calm is probably restored. If for the meteorologist, the storm begins, peaks, and ends, for the land that forms the lap of that sea, the storm is preserved forever in the shore's contours. For those who lose homes and people to it, the storm rewrites the plot of being, altering without end the life. So the mark of the storm, or the story in my analogy, is ongoingness, And we delude ourselves to think that any of these stories that we hear ever end. Do you remember when you were like an intern or a junior resident? You said, well, I've taken care of that. She'll be fine. And it was kind of a blow when she'd come back, not with a headache this time, but with something else. And you say, oh, it never ends. So we don't know the beginning and the ending of the diseases or the conditions. We do our best with sheet and line. And yet, how many eroded coasts have we traveled? How many shipwrecks have we seen? The fiction writer Alexander Heman recently published a personal essay in The New Yorker. I hope you read it. Did you read it? It's called The Aquarium. Go find it. He writes about the death of his baby daughter from a brain tumor. Quote, I could not have begun to imagine the intensity of the pain we felt as the nurses removed the tubes and wires and everyone cleared out and Terry and I held our dead child. How do you step out of a moment like that? How do you leave your dead child behind and return to the vacant routines of whatever you might call your life? So the stories, be they as tragic as the death of the baby from a brain tumor or not, these stories have no beginnings and middles and ends. And so the duty that many of us feel within clinical practice to have, the simplest way I can say it, is to have a sense of story. The duty to develop and use that sense of story is fraught. It means that you're to be opened to conditions that have no end and that are always, always requiring of you continued comprehension, compassion, and action. It's what's necessary to understand what the parents of that dying baby might need, is one way to think about what is this sense of story. And it's with that that we can maybe contribute what might help. And one way to think about what this sense of story is to imagine, or just to remember, times when it was absent. We've all seen it. I overhear a conversation in the hospital, in Presbyterian Hospital. Two ladies are talking. One says, out of my sight, but I hear them. One says, oh, it's such a big place. You could get lost here. I always like to know where I'm going. And the second lady says, right, go down this hall, turn left at the corner, take the elevator to B, and you'll be in radiation oncology. So as I overhear that, I understand immediately, I narrativize it, I fill in the blanks, and I imagine that she's on her way to her first appointment at radiation oncology for some cancer. And I realize that she's not going to find her way in this lostness, and she's not going to find the certainty that she's looking for. When I told that story later that night to a group of EBM doctors at a conference I was teaching at, two of them looked at me like that. Like, why are you telling me that? They didn't understand it. They were kind of mad at me. Why are you wasting my time? And I could imagine they're giving that same, it's like a stunned steer look to a patient who was trying to explain something about a year ago when the baby died. Why are you telling me that? So that's a doctor without a sense of story. So, you know, I've worked with several of you over the last day and on previous visits, so I don't have to go into all the business of where this narrative medicine came from, but I just want to tell you in a sentence or two that my colleagues and I at Columbia for many, many years, for decades, have been working with persons in primary care medicine, in communication skills, in in humanities and medicine, in bioethics, all of these different fields that try to describe and even equip clinicians with some of these skills of reaching patients and understanding and educating and being dutiful. But we developed something that we ended up naming narrative medicine because it was not altogether this kind of literature and medicine, you know, what did Millie Thiel die of? I mean, you know, the study of fiction that portrays illness. Nor was it strictly bioethical, because we did lots more than just think about the quandaries that happen in the ICU. We felt that what we were beginning to develop was really fundamental to being around sickness, which had to do with this sense of story, which had to do with how do you, what does it take to receive what a patient emits? And I use emit rather than tell, because of course there are many channels of language and silence and gesture and liver biopsy. So whatever the patient emits needs to be received. And we knew that there were, that we lacked many of the capacities to receive that which is being emitted. And they were cognitive, imaginative, perspectival, ethical lacks. And we thought that the training in really rigorous reading, writing, listening, working with rigor on how stories work on the teller and the listener and the contract between them might replenish or provide the skills that are missing from that doctor who looks like a stunned steer when I tell him the story about this patient. So that was kind of the designing idea. Not that we thought we were in any way replacing what people in medical humanities do or social sciences, but that we were being rather ravenous in bringing in ideas and methods from more than the humanities, social sciences, anthropology, lived experience, as well as some aspects of creative work that is sometimes left out. And then what rather baffled us or surprised us was how many people were interested. And we started by offering these tiny little workshops, you know, hoping that we'd get 20 people or 30 people, and they were overflowed as soon as we opened them up. And we discovered a hunger among clinicians as well as among scholars in related fields to come into what felt very quickly to be this clearing, this, you know, like in a forest, the clearing where persons of different creatures can come with some degree of safety and hear from one another and work with one another. And there were things that could be said in such settings that were unsayable elsewhere. When we did work, and it was always in very elemental, not elementary, but elemental skills of reading, writing, listening, decoding, interpreting, retelling. When we did these things with teams who worked together in the hospital, adult oncology, doctors, nurses, administrators, chaplains, social workers, when we did this kind of work, instead of case conferences, for example, we very quickly let persons get underneath what typically separated them. So they weren't fussing about, does the chemotherapy nurse or does somebody else? There was no fussing. And I don't know, at Columbia, there's a lot of fussing that goes on between doctors and nurses, or between nurses and social workers. Blah, blah, blah. Who's the case manager? And this simply did away with that. We were underneath those distinctions, under the silos, if you will, on, I think, the ground of the patient's suffering. And all we did, literally, was say, write about a patient whose suffering has moved you. and be ready, if you like, to read aloud what you've written. And we suddenly discover that these people, they've worked together for 10, 15, 20 years and they didn't know anything about one another. And this simple intervention enabled them to become more transparent. So, at this point, we've had to offer a master of science degree in narrative medicine because persons come to our workshops, they want to go home and do this. They're not equipped yet because it's not easy. And so we started a master's program. We're now in our fourth year. We've taken in only 25 students a year. We could take in 100 if we wanted to, but we don't want them because each one needs to be carefully taught. And what do they do once they get their master's? They go off and run programs. Okay? Next time you want me to come, I'm not going to come. I'm going to send Susan Ball, who's one of my graduates, who's a HIV doctor at NYU, at New York Hospital. And she's now running a program in narrative medicine at Cornell. See? Et cetera. I mean, they're all over the place. They're at McGill. They're in Tel Aviv. They're in London. They're in Taiwan. So, that attests to the lacks that we see being filled by these, again, elemental, not elementary, skills. And I think, going along with LCME and ACGME and all the other acronyms, that it is helpful to those of us within these educations to think in terms of skills, to not think in terms of, you know who I have a fuss with at Columbia? Forgive me. The Gold Foundation. Oh, they're very nice. They talk about humanism in medicine. Well, I'm not sure what that means. Be humanistic. What do you say to that? Either sure or no. Typically the answer is, hey man, I'd love to be, but I don't know how. And so our tack has been more to supply the skills, the prerequisites, if you will, that enable, if you choose, you to be a humanistic doctor. So we've been studying this work. We know what some of at least the intermediates are in the work. When we work with healthcare teams, and we do pre and post administration of various surveys, and mostly we do a lot of focus groups and ethnographic interviews, the team coherence or cohesion increases, where there's not such difference between what the nurse thinks should happen and what the doctor thinks should happen. In one study we did at the beginning a stressor scale. This was on a pediatric oncology group. We did a stressor scale, and all the different disciplines involved rated the stress that they felt on these different axes of, you know, all the patients die, your colleagues are incompetent, the structure of the hospital doesn't work, the different things that might make it, there's no time for my personal life. And it was all very high on all the measured axes, and they were very different from one group to the other. At the end of our 6 week, we did once a week sessions for, and said, if you want to be in the study, you got to come 6 times. That's all, 6. And they came, they read, they wrote, they read aloud. That's all. At the end, the level of stress didn't come down. In fact, it increased. So these don't band-aid. This doesn't make it easier. If anything, it makes it more visible how hard it is. The separation between the groups diminished drastically. That, to me, is a finding. They also said in the focus groups that what we did in the seminar spilled over to the wards. And they gave us examples of particular children. This was on peds oncology. Particular children and families who they were able to understand in different ways, leading to different kinds of interventions. What I want, and then we also do the same with the teaching. We do lots of narrative medicine teaching. All PNS students are required to take seminars. Now at the end of their first year, we have a fourth year narrative medicine elective that's very competitive. We have a new scholarly project requirement at Columbia. All the fourth year students are required to do 4 months in one of six tracks. And I got one track in narrative and social medicine. And I made it be narrative and social medicine because I've learned from UNC. So it's, I didn't want it to sound like it was the arts and humanities. It's not that. It's the practice of medicine within the full awareness and perception of the lived experience of patients. And that can come from anthropology just as well as it can come from Henry James. Right? But in any case, so the students are now doing these extensive graduate level serious projects in narrative medicine. So when we ask the students what happens as a result of these seminars, they feel more affiliated with one another among themselves, the students. They feel more affiliated with patients. They feel more affiliated with what they call, I find rather sorrowfully, normal persons. Tuesday was the day I felt most like a normal person, which is a little alarming. They found themselves listening differently, more attentively, less defensively. I'm reading from the focus group things. Absorbing more from the teller than they thought they could. So whether it's, you know, a novel by Michael Ondaatje or a conversation, they found means to place themselves more in contact. They simply understood more of the stories that they were heard because we taught them about how stories work. And they were able to identify, well, this is this kind of narrator, and this is why, and oh, this is recurring. And they got very interested in this kind of rigorous, high-level means of taking in what someone was telling them. It was remarkable. They were happy to use different parts of their brains, parts that they missed, and I'm sure your medicine and society students will say the same thing. They realized that there's no beginnings, middles, and ends of these stories around illness, but that they're all total storms. And then one of the most, I thought, convincing outcomes, I was asked to write a chapter in the behavioral medicine textbook that a lot of us use, edited by Feldman et al. And it's kind of the textbook that we've been using for years and years in our interviewing course and healthcare systems course. And it's got, you know, chapters on the kinds of things you'd imagine. Taking care of patients with domestic violence or end-of-life conversations, that kind of thing. So they asked me to write a chapter on narrative medicine. It was Rich Frankel. How can you say no to Rich Frankel? So I said, sure, and then I turned to my faculty group and said, come on, let's write a chapter. And we did. And we did it simply, I put out two queries. Tell me, write me a story of a student who you think benefited by narrative medicine methods, and write me a story of a patient who you think benefited from narrative methods in your practice. And I got floods of response. I'm talking to 20 people, and I got 10 or 12 back on each of those queries. And they were very specific. The ones that I was impressed with was their practice. Their practice. These were endocrinologists and pediatricians and anesthesiologists and psychiatrists. So one told about writing about a patient so as to understand what she herself thought about that patient. One wrote about asking a patient to write herself about specific aspects of the illness, which exposed a lot of very mysterious elements of the illness. Recruiting colleagues to write what has been written, looking in effect for readers of what you've written about your practice. Changing interviewing routines within the practice so as to hear a different kind of story to begin with. And these were sustained, rather radical changes in the practice. They realized that they had been squandering evidence in their practices because it was encoded in words. And our training showed them, our narrative medicine training, showed them how to fully use the evidence to make decisions. So I'm making the case. I said I wasn't going to convince you, but I guess that's what I'm doing, that this rather simple and rather inexpensive training equips us with skills of attentive listening, fine perception. I'm going to stop there before going on in this litany. In order to perceive something, you have to have the language for it. We know that. The best description of this is from Hans Lowald, who's a psychoanalytic theorist, who says, writing is a sensory motor act whereby one transforms the immaterial into the material, thereby making it visible to self and tellable to others. So in order to make visible one's lived experience, one has to find language to contain it. We know that from many different aspects. You've all been reading the New York Times Why Fiction Changes Your Brain. But that the conferring of form onto chaotic experience is what enables us to perceive it. Were I a painter, I could do that in painting. I'm not a painter, but I'm a writer. I think more of us have facility with writing than with painting. But I'm not excluding other means of representation. But one of the theoretical pivots of the work is that unless experience is composed, it remains out of reach. So when I ask a student to write about the patient who died in the cardiac arrest effort, that student, for the first time, is placing the events, emotions, sounds, sights, feelings, memories into a way in which that student can then read it, have others read it, and it becomes real and it becomes visible. I can go on a limb and say we don't experience our experience until we represent it. And this is what keeps being clear and clear and clear as students or colleagues or participants at these courses. Simply write. I mean, some of you did this yesterday. Simply write from memory about some thing that occurred to you. And in the writing of it, one gains access to parts of it one didn't see. And this is simply demonstrated over and over in a workshop with floods of tears as the writer says, but I didn't know it was about my father. It happens routinely. People leave our workshops and they say, what did you do to me? I feel transformed. And they can't wait to come back. We've got a big, big project with the VA because we gave one little workshop for 40 clinicians from VA hospitals in the area, and they're like deluging us with requests, please, can we come back? When do you come back next? We said, okay, we'll go. Most of them are from Washington, D.C. Said, we'll come back. We'll do some more training in June. Well, there's already like 100 people who want to be in this thing. And it may go national very quickly. So what I'm saying is these elemental skills are seen very quickly to matter to those who learn them. Okay. Let me end with a description of a patient, and then we'll talk. At the very end of the essay by Alexander Hemin, he says this about the death of his daughter Isabel. He realizes that, quote, her indelible absence is now an organ in our bodies. whose sole function is a continuous secretion of sorrow. So that if we're effective in working with persons who are ill, suffering, and losing, we will, in the midst of this storm, sense the physiology of loss, not as something that will end. It's indelible. It's a continuous secretion of sorrow, not as something that will end, but as a story that lives on, altering without end its life, engaging all who undergo it and who accompany it in a community of witness and care. Now, I want to give you an example of why this can matter with an individual patient. I saw an elderly man not long ago in the office. It was his first visit to me. I'm in the medicine clinic, so people get randomly appointed. This is an older guy who was sent to me by the cardiologist because he needed a general internist and had not been getting along with the internist he was seeing. This was not very promising, and I didn't feel up to it that day at all. I was impatient, I was rushed, I was completely out of his reach. But he reached me with his softness, his patience. He was very ill already. His resignation with which he accepted his frailty. I was reached by the joy that was evident in his description of his home in the Dominican Republic and his life here in New York with his wife. And I slowly felt my voice drop in volume and my actions slow and my seat be taken with more care. I stopped writing. I sat back in the chair, gazing at him, probably with sadness on my face, but also, I hoped, with regard and with respect. I remember the interpreter, this was all in Spanish. My Spanish is okay, but I always use an interpreter. He says, he gets tired toweling himself after a shower. So the man was very impaired. I found myself explaining to him, and I wondered why I was doing this. Other than his heart, his health was very good. And I realized I wanted to give him something, because I felt he had given something to me. When I performed the physical exam, including a rectal and genital exam that the other internist had not done, and where the patient had some painful blisters, I felt like I was fulfilling my duty to him as a doctor. I felt wordless gratitude for the work I do, for the loveliness this gentle man brought into my life, for the peace that descends at moments like this of contact. And then I prepared to be his doctor. It was as if during the visit, he opened a door into his life, and he asked me to enter it. I know the life he opens the door to is going to get hard. I had the records. I knew this was irreversible failure. He was looking at a future of profound disability, and I was being asked to walk into a room of fear and loss and sorrow. I knew that I could be his internist without going in the room. I could send him back to the cardiologist. I could do the pre-op clearance. I could do the other, still another stress down. But I chose to enter the room, even though I know what it means to enter the room. It means accompanying him on his decline. It means not just measuring the decline, but taking part in what the decline means. It means not being an outsider to the process of his failure of health, and it would mean sharing his losses. So it sounds like entering that room takes courage. I think it does. I think it takes a steadfastness. But I think it takes skill. To walk into that room takes skill to imagine what might be in there, to to picture what might be in there, to imagine what it must be like to have the disease that will end your life. But it's only as I wrote this description of having met this patient, and I did it 6 hours after I met him, it was only in the writing of it that I understood what it meant to me. And had I not written just then about this visit with this elderly man, I would not have captured what it meant. I would not have gotten the moment, the significance. And the chances are, and this is the hope of this kind of work, chances are that not squandering that meaning will alter the care I can give him. So that's the hope. That's the hope that in the relatively soon to come, that we'll have enough kind of manpower and dollars to actually do clinical outcomes, to actually saturate some practices with robust narrative methods, and to have some comparison with others that are similar but not saturated. And that we would see, I propose, over a period of someplace between 1 and 2 years, we would see not only adherence in follow-up visits or, oh good, you got your mammogram, but in blood pressure and in smoking cessation and in A1Cs. That's what I think. I can't say that for sure, but that's where we're heading. So there you have it. Thank you for listening. Please.
Hi, I'm Kim Rowland.
Hi.
Hi. Well, one of the things that I'm seeing when patient satisfaction scores haven't been very good, and I'll see patients with enema, and I see that they've left out because it is finding out who the patient is as a person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what patients want.
Yeah.
And satisfaction
scores
do increase.
They do. In what setting is it?
It can be in surgery, it can be in medicine.
Yeah.
It's just finding out.
Yeah.
Just 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes it's just a matter of inverting the order of things we do. So when I and now many of my colleagues, when we meet a new patient, instead of going into the drill of when were you last in the hospital, what are your operations, what are your allergies, are you short of breath, do you have chest pain? Instead of entering the drill at all, I always start with the same 2 sentences. I will be your doctor, and so I need to know a great deal about your body and your health and your life. Please tell me what you think I should know about your situation. And I've trained myself to not say any more, and to not write, and to not type, but to sit in my chair, usually hands in lap, listening. And unlike my colleagues say, Rita, that must go on for hours. It doesn't. It doesn't. What it does is give the patient the power to frame the events of illness, whatever they're worried about, to frame it within whatever they think it ought to be framed in. So that the patient is the one who gets the first bid at saying, what's the trouble? And I've trained myself to listen even when it doesn't sound medically salient, with the conviction that whatever comes up in tell me what you think I should know about your situation, that I'm going to hear things that I need to know. And then it never goes beyond 12, 15 minutes. It really doesn't. They'll say, well, that's the end of that. And then in the physical exam or later on, I make sure to say, well, your last PPD, and did you have your pap test, and all the rest of it. But boy, does that ever launch us on the ground of the patient's lived experience and not what my preconceived ideas are about what might be up.
Mm-hmm.
Uh, I think they've never been asked to do it. I don't think it's that they can't. They just don't know that that's what to do. Try it. Bail it and then hear.
Well, you know, I really like the story you told it down. When you wrote it down, where did you write it?
Thank you for asking that. I wrote it, you know, home on my machine. Certainly not in the EMR. Although I do typically write my progress notes after I've seen a patient, and I always give patients a copy of what I've written. And so I've learned to write in language that my patients can understand. And so I've learned to put into the record what really happens, which is not always the case for some of the notes. If we spend half the time talking about I got a new car, well, that's going to go in the medical record to perhaps the dismay of the intern in the ER. I'm not sure about that. Do you see? But so, no, in this case, I wrote this, and I think I was already in the middle of writing an essay that somebody had asked me to write. I quite forget the sequence. But it was something that I felt said something that was helpful. So I saw the patient, the next time I saw the patient, with the same interpreter, I said, you know, after you left, I thought about you a lot. I thought over what happened, and I found that I really tried to understand what's going on. I even wrote something about it. And the patient said, in Spanish with the interpreter, you did? And he said, the patient, I remember that too. I remember when we first met. And I remember there was something, he remembered that we made contact. That's right. So there's what I'm doing is making a distinction between what goes into the EMR, what may go elsewhere. We call them at Columbia the parallel chart, which is where the student can write something that doesn't belong in the hospital chart but has to be written. There are problems about discoverability. If you're going to get sued, can they go into your hard drive, into your Mac, and find? These are questions. The bigger questions, and these are alarming sometimes, are HIPAA questions that the students don't seem to capture for themselves, and house staff. And you get these blogs, and these ER residents are putting things on the blogs about the vaginal bleeding that came in on Saturday night, and anybody can find it. These are illegal, and we have to be very aware of those. But that those are the fringes of your question. I think that we all need our own parallel chart, if you like. It can be destroyed. Afterwards, I tire of the students. Where do you think I can submit this, Dr. Sharon? I wrote a story. I say, no. The story has done its work. The story has done its work. See? Please.
So I'm particularly interested in handoffs.
Ah, good.
Communication.
Good.
And the retelling.
Yes.
Ideas. One of the things that has struck me is that since we now have EMRs, we are even less likely to really tell the patient's stories.
Mm-hmm.
And we often will hear the stories on rounds or sitting at breakfast.
Yeah.
And you'll hear the real story behind what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so now everybody thinks the electronic medical record is the greatest thing and that we communicate through that. And we don't talk to each other. We don't really talk and retell the story through the chart.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the 8-hour work week and all of the
pressures,
there are fewer people around to share that story with on a continuous basis.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we do that?
Yes.
I'm struck by, because I tend to write longer narratives in my notes, and I know which of my partners do and which don't. So I know if I need to know what the
Yes.
So
how interesting. Couldn't that be a metric?
Absolutely.
Whose note do you go searching for? There's a metric.
And how many notes are cut and pasted?
Well, the cut and paste Liz yesterday, Dresser, was so inflamed about the cut and paste, and it's bogus. But also the very act of doing it is instructive. It gains us access to what we know but is out of awareness. And it's in the writing itself that we gain awareness. And we got to do better than lament. We can't succumb to lamentation. And we fully are happy with what the EMR does for us, and I can get the MR immediately, and I can get a beautiful flow diagram of the HbA, the A1C, all that stuff. It's great. But we can't pay with this. So we have to be smart enough to figure out how not to pay. And maybe if we get rid of the cut and paste and block and copy functions, that'll help. I don't know. How do we all think about this trade-off?
Yeah. And getting the 20 volumes for Mr. So-and-so.
Yeah.
But I got a story out of
it. Weren't they delicious?
You know, fairly quickly. And everybody wrote all their progress notes in the same section.
That's right.
Nursing, social services.
Right.
So you could read a narrative in the progress notes.
Well, you know what we need? It wouldn't be hard. Take one of the medical wards in your hospital and compare it to the other medical wards, but with the experimental one, for a month reinstitute the paper chart, or for a month do you see what I mean? We simply need to line up these different methods and see what's being lost and what's being gained. It may not even take that long for the differences to emerge in things like handoffs. I think handoffs is a very handy tool for examining some of these things. I agree. Readmissions, of course, is the other one. Please, Warren. Yes. We're good friends. We see one another a lot. When she's in New York, we get together. I go out to Sausalito. I see her. So we're not peas in a pod, but we're engaged in the same hopes. I believe that Rachel's work is more perhaps interior. I think its goal, its mission, is more concentrated on the well-being of the clinician. Not that she doesn't think beyond that, but that the method is targeted toward the clinician, and typically, in your case, the very junior one, toward that little student. When she does retreats at Sausalito, it's often with older practitioners. Our work is kind of a little more systematic. It deals with things like how teams work. Yeah. Exactly. It's more structured in language skills. Yeah.
I wonder though if it's not correct.
Right.
And how maybe that's made you need to offer it but not require it and let people sell to you. I mean, in a way it's almost like personal therapy. Like,
yes.
Like you have to come to it on your own.
Yes. Yes.
And so the idea of like we're going to make every medical student could be counterproductive because like, oh, we've got to write another.
Right, right. No, no, no. Here, I'm glad you asked that. So when we do the narrative medicine required seminars, there's like 12 or 14 of them offered at once, and the students have to pick one among the 12 or 14 in the catalog. About half are related to language, and the other half are not. So there's a fiction writing workshop, there's a poetry workshop, there's, this year we got, what, I could boast about the lineup, but we have one of the science writers, senior science writer at the New York Times, doing a seminar for our students in nonfiction science writing. We also have students doing figure drawing, others going to museum courses to increase their perception by virtue of looking at visual art. We've had composers, so that there are many avenues. What unifies them, there's a cinema course. What unifies them is that they're ways of representing experience. All right? In years past, not this year, but in the past, we've had oral history or spoken word, which is a somewhat rarefied version of complexly telling stories. So I agree, not everybody's into James, but there's got to be a means to represent what one has been through in order to experience it. And I hope you have readers for your journal.
No, I don't.
That you find yourself some readers. I mean, if you get five people together, each of whom is keeping a medical journal, and you get together once a month and read to one another from your journals, then you'll find out what you wrote. A writer can't read his own stuff. I think we're at the end of our time.
Thank you, everybody.
We got to go.
Hope to see some of you at 3:00.